I'll open us in prayer real quick, and then everybody else can scooch on in here. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we just ask that you would bless this time. Help us to be open to hearing your history through this book and Christian historians, and help us to just take these things and file them into our minds, and so that it helps us think about how we should act in today's culture. I pray that it would help us to just deepen our understanding and our love for you and love for our neighbor, and in our love for this world you made and in this community you've put us in. Just bless this time in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. All right, so we are continuing our study through this book, A Theological Interpretation of American History, by Greg Singer, or C. Greg. I don't know what the C stands for. So we began with the foundation of when America began, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, their theological views and how it shaped the founding of this country. We then moved on to deism last week. And this week we are going to talk about transcendentalism. Now, you were quick on the definition of deism last week. Does anybody know what transcendentalism is?
Deism, God deceived.
Yes. Yes. Would you like to expand?
There's this God up there somewhere, this energy source that we can tap into. And
yes. This is, you could call this Star Wars theology. The Force. So the Oxford Dictionary definition is an idealistic philosophical and social movement which developed in New England around 1836. I don't know why they got such a specific date, but in reaction to rationalism. So rationalism is what we talked about last week with deism and Unitarianism. Influenced by Romanticism, Platonism, and Kantian philosophy, it taught that divinity pervades all nature and humanity, and its members held progressive views on feminism and communal living. Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau were central figures. This is Singer's definition. Primarily a religious philosophy, a revolt against the Enlightenment of the 18th century, and a reaction against the unrestrained devotion of that era to the scientific method. So this right here, when before we get started, I meant to talk about this last week real quick. And this is my own sort of interpretation here, but it is interesting how these movements are not just a rebellion against Christianity. They're a rebellion also about against the previous movement. But the next movement is never, oh, this is not smart, this is not wise, let's go back to previous. Remember, even last week I talked about how, you know, deism and the Enlightenment was a return to the Renaissance, not the Reformation. So it's a rejection of what's coming before, but it's not trying to correct it, or at least not actually. I mean, maybe they think they are, but... But what it is, it seems like there's always this moment where they could, okay, we don't like rationalism. We could go back to the Bible. Nah, I think we'll actually go even farther this way. And you see this all through history. I mean, as we go through this study, you're going to see that it gets more and more ridiculous as we go. I mean, we're going to come into Darwinianism and the social gospel and sometimes I think if you were to talk to some of these transcendentalists or deists today and tell, you know, and show them what the world, what America was like, you know, their minds would be blown. They would just like, what in the world? Like, what happened? Like, you did this. But and of course, Singer would believe this. He's a good Reformed historian. You know, obviously, this whole the whole reason why these movements happen is because of sin. I mean, the people are rejecting God. Even the Puritans, we talked about the reasons why that project and that experiment, that theology ended up failing, but ultimately it's because of sin, because man does not like to submit to God. They want to be their own master. Transcendentalism sort of takes that idea and just, runs with it. So remember what deism and Unitarianism offered: a disinterested God who was not involved or interested in the affairs of man. This was a rejection of the theology of the Puritans, and it allowed men to be their own authority. Democracy meant that men were accountable to men, and their authority was derived from their fellow man. Deism did away with the rule of God in the same way that the revolution did away with the rule of England. You know, it's we don't want authority figures, so... You know, the theology sort of took its cue from that. You know, we don't want authority. We don't want, whether it be a king or whether it be God, we don't want authority. We want to be in control of our own destiny. And certainly there's an element there where we want liberty, we want freedoms, but there's a right way to go about it, and then there's a wrong way to go about it. So deism, though, left a wide chasm in the hearts of many people. A distant God is not very comforting, not very lovely. But rather than return to the God of the Puritans, men began looking inward for God. And Singer says this. He says, deism's coldness and reliance upon rationalism proved to be quite unsatisfactory for those who wanted a warmth in their philosophical outlook and religious quest. Further, many of these, smart men noticed that there was inconsistencies in deism. For instance, they rejected supernatural events. They rejected the miracles of the Bible. They still believed in God. They still believed in heaven. They still believed in hell. They still had believed that you had to do good. You know, there was a moral aspect to deism. I mean, that's what makes, when you go back and read the Founding Fathers, that's what makes it sometimes difficult to know whether they were Christian or not, because even the deists spoke in a way that seems very Christian. And as I mentioned before, I mean, it's kind of a gray area. I mean, it's not like they just rejected God like this. It was a slow process. And so there were a lot of, like John Locke, I mentioned him. You know, some people debate, was he a Christian, was he not? I mean, you read some works of him, and he is defending Christianity and Christ. But again, he's also introducing these elements of, well, the Bible's good and all, but there's other, we need to be able to judge for ourselves whether, these things are true. And since we can't believe that miracles happen, let's not, we don't need the miracles in the Bible. A slippery slope. But so these deists are seeing these, the transcendentalists are seeing the inconsistencies in deism, and they're also seeing inconsistencies in the morality. So these men that reject God, reject the Bible, reject the authority in the law, are still living according to it. But that, we could say that's kind of a grace. I mean, that was happening because consistently they wouldn't have been doing that. And you do see in history men that are quickly, as soon as that door is open a little bit, they are using it for their own self-service. But there are still a lot of very moral, ethical men and women during this time who are deists, who are Unitarians, and they're not really living consistently with their worldview, thankfully. 18th century Unitarianism was not creedless. Again, it wasn't the Unitarianism of today. If you go down the street, I don't know if there's any around here, but there's a couple of Unitarian churches in Nashville. If you go down the street and visited one of their churches, it's nothing like the Unitarianism of the 17th and 18th century. The Unitarianism was not creedless, and it was highly ethical in character. But its creed and ethical system rested upon the flimsy foundation of rationalism and naturalism rather than on the scriptures as an infallible revelation. One of the funny things I read was, as the Transcendental Movement was taking shape, some of the Unitarians saw this and they were horrified by it. They saw the implications of what was happening. It says, he gives the account that Professor Andrews Norton at Harvard, who was, you know, by this time Harvard is the liberal college, Princeton is the still the very Calvinistic reform conservative college. And so this very convinced liberal theologian, this Unitarian, who was living, you know, he was on the far left of Unitarianism, he saw this transcendentalism taking shape and was horrified by it and knew that he couldn't do anything and say anything about it. So he called on the Princeton Calvinists. He said, "Your job, you need to fight this." And I think it's hilarious because it really is. It's like the strange bedfellows you see today. You know, it's the liberals who they rejected Christianity, you know, for whatever, let's say feminism. And now they find themselves in this situation where men are coming into their ranks and competing in women's sports and they don't know what to do about it, like their worldview. And so they're looking to Christians. They're like, "You need to do something about this. You need to help us. You need to put a stop to this." Well, you know, it's funny. They're crawling back to us like, "Hey, what do we do here?" And this is the same thing. These universalists and Unitarianists are, they don't know what to say because they kind of started this thing. This is the, like Abe said, this is the implications of Unitarianism. So on the one hand, you had a system that rejected supernaturalism and biblical authority. But there was still a belief in God and Jesus and heaven and hell. How could you consistently reject one and not the other? On the other hand, if God had no authority, if his word was not trustworthy, then there was no foundation for the outworking of morality. Transcendentalism rose out of these inconsistencies. So let's talk about the history of transcendental. We now know what it is. Where did it come from? Many historians trace transcendentalism back to the philosophy of Immanuel Kant in the late 1800s. In his book, Critique of Pure Reason, Kant was pushing back against the rationalism that we read last week of John Locke and Isaac Newton. He called it transcendental idealism. And the idea is that there are certain things that you cannot know empirically, such as space and time. So remember John Locke and Isaac Newton, these guys are saying the way that you know truth is that you can test it. You can reach out, you can grab it, you can know it firsthand. Kant is actually sitting there going, well, some things maybe, like there's a need for this, but that doesn't explain a lot of things. Space, time. So he says that we come to know these things intuitively. In other words, through science, for instance, one can know how things really are, but Kant argues that some things we can only know as they appear to us. So space is out there, and we can't reach out and grab it, but we can have an intuitive understanding of what it is. And what it truly is doesn't matter so much as how we intuit what it is, what it means to us. It's reality, it's defining, it's cohesion is from our point of view. And you can see how this thinking influenced the transcendental religious movement, because God, you know, is unknowable apart from his word, you know. And so if you truly want to know God, you can't do it through rational thought or scientific processes, but perhaps you can do it intuitively. The problem with this, of course, is that God then becomes just whatever you want him to be. Along with Kant, the transcendentalists were also greatly influenced by the romantic writers of the 18th century. Poets like William Blake, William Wordsworth, and Samuel Coleridge. And if you ever get a chance, Paul Johnson's books sort of gets into some of these men. Coming off the top of my head, Intellectuals. And he talks about some of these guys and how inconsistent they were. Like their viewpoints didn't match up with the way they lived. So Coleridge was writing these very moving and influential books. And meanwhile, he was constantly high on opium, abandoning his family, just being a causing all kinds of trouble. The Transcendental Movement is known for its love of nature. Well, Coleridge was a big influence on this because he's the first guy to kind of go out and traverse this mountainside. And it turned out he was just really high and he got lost. And the only way down was he figured out was going down this mountain. He became the, you know, this inspiration, but he was just high. So Coleridge in particular, and Coleridge wrote Rime of the Ancient Mariner, for instance, if you know that. But he had a big impact on guys like Ralph Waldo Emerson. But also there was the American Romantic writers, so men like Washington Irving, James Fenimore Cooper, Nathaniel Hawthorne. And they took this transcendental idea, and then they also added this American flavor to it, so rugged individualism and a love of nature. And that's really what shaped the Transcendental Movement, all these things put together. And just for lack of time, I mean, there's a lot of people that we could talk about. There's George Ripley, Frederick Hedge, Theodore Parker. These men were actually the biggest influences or the biggest leaders in the Transcendental Movement, but we don't know them. Who we know is Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. So I'll mostly be talking about them. Emerson is mostly well known for his essays, and he began writing these in the 1840s. So this is the time period we're looking at, before the Civil War. Richard Weaver remarks in his critical essay on Emerson. I just happened to be reading Weaver at the same time, and remember last week I mentioned the providence of my apologetics class I'm taking just happened to have me read Locke and Grotius, who I was critiquing, and then, you know, got to read a little bit of them. Well, just, again, providentially, I'm reading Richard Weaver's essays from the 60s, the Southern Agrarian Essays, and he has two essays critiquing Emerson and Thoreau. I mean, devastating critiques. They're fantastic. But he critiques Emerson because, I mean, it's this essay basically that is about the evils of a man-centered theology. That if you take away sin from the equation, you are going to have utter destruction. And he says the reason why the Southern writers are better than these Northern writers is because they never forgot that. They always understood that there was sin, there was a sin nature, that sin was always present, that sin was destructive. So he says this. He says, "Once I heard a teacher say that Emerson was the man who put the dynamite under New England." And he says he never really understood what that meant and just assumed it referred to Emerson's influence in his writings. But years later, he was reading a Southern author who was a contemporary of Emerson, and this guy said, "The theory of the natural goodness of man will blow up any society on which it is founded." And he said that curiously cohered. Emerson was dynamite. Of course he was, because he believed that man was inherently good and that there was no such thing as sin. That's what blew up New England. This view of man, of course, was a continuation of the deistic view of man, that man is inherently good and can achieve perfection. Emerson, though, took this idea to his next logical step. Not only is man good, but there is no such thing as sin. Evil was essentially non-existent. It was simply a privation of reality. Sin exists, evil exists only because people haven't been educated enough. If we can just educate them and make them better people, we can do away with sin. Weaver goes on to say that Emerson, having decided that there was nothing divine outside himself to issue demands or pronounce rebukes, he arrived not at victory, but at complacency. This complacency is what characterized the Transcendental Movement as getting back to nature. You know, Thoreau goes off to Walden and spends 2 years away from society. Well, Thoreau, right before that, had spent a night in prison for some silly, he didn't, I forget what it is now, but he didn't pay something, and he got put in prison for a day, and he got really angry about it, and so he goes off to the woods. you know, and oh, well, society stinks and authority stinks. And so that's where this whole, you know, his whole view comes from, is just he's angsty. He would have been a great like 90s rocker. But Thoreau, of course, is most famous for this in his book Walden. But Emerson also attempted to get away from society through the founding of Brook Farm Colony, which was a socialist. And again, socialism is sort of at its beginnings here, but it was the first type of socialist commune in New England. I'll mention that a little bit later. But so let's talk about the theological influence of transcendentalism. A further departure from deism is seen in Emerson's essay on the Oversoul. Science fiction here, but so he describes the Oversoul as an impersonal spirit and the reality of all nature. He says this: standing on the bare ground, my head bathed in the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I became a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all the currents of the universe being circulated through me. I am part and parcel of God. So this is Emerson. Emerson held that there is a universal mind of God, which is the common property of all men, and each man is the incarnation of that mind. So we are all part of nature, and God is part of nature, so God is all part of us. And if you want to know God, you just got to find within yourself who God is. Singer says that in their efforts to free religion from the dictates of natural law, the transcendentalists declared their independence from all objective norms of truth and made the individual the ultimate authority and judge of what was true or false in religion. That, of course, has problems. The implications of that are enormous, but Emerson and Thoreau didn't necessarily acknowledge this, but some of the other guys like Ripley and Theodore Parker recognized this. They were actually pastors, so I think they actually kind of were still had one foot in the ethical, you know, world. But so they saw the implications of this, but they were on board. Like they saw options here, and they were like, you know, we can't get rid of this thinking, but we need to figure out a way to just keep man from just, you know, falling off the edge of the cliff. So what Theodore Parker said was, He tried to cut this off by teaching that piety was the subjective form of religion and that morality was the objective form of it. So in other words, because all men have God in them, it is their duty to act the way God would act. And so they sort of, again, obviously, how do you know how God acts if you don't have God's word? But there was this sort of, you know, understood, oh, well, God clearly would love, you know, would love people. God clearly would not steal. God clearly would not do violence upon others. And so these transcendentalist pastors were preaching like, if you want to know God, then you do good to other people, and that's how God is shining forth through you. So he's basically borrowing from the Bible, but not wanting to acknowledge the Bible. You know, of course, as Christians, we believe, you know, that God, we showed Christ to others in the way that we treat others. And he likes that. I mean, that's clearly, obviously, the way we should be living. But he doesn't want all the other stuff that the Bible has to say. Now, politically, and I'll get to this real quick, too. There's a lot more you could say about the theology of it. But I do want to get into the politics here before we run out of time. The transcendentalists were actually a small group. There wasn't a big movement. It was a small movement, and it was a movement made up of these, you know, these men that could actually just take the time and sit around and write and go to Walden. And, you know, they weren't, again, it's sort of this inconsistently, like the common man is out there working and striving and trying to build a society, and these are the people that are sitting off to the side and sort of contemplating life and getting angry because they got put in prison for not paying, you know, their parking ticket or whatever. And but they did have a wide influence. So I mentioned the farm that they started. You know, these transcendentalists would be at this farm and they were writing a lot. You know, Emerson, Thoreau, but there were a lot of others. They started a newspaper called The Dial. This was a widely read newspaper that was very influential on the common man. And so this paper was going out to everybody, and these men who appear wise are writing constantly. And what they did is they critiqued every form of institution in society. And so here you have these people that have just gone through revolution, and they have cast away, in a sense, the authoritarianism of you know, England. And there's this whole sort of rugged individualism. And so this very much appeals to the common man. They see, oh, yeah, this is great. Like, I don't need to be subject to anyone. Like, I'm my own person, and this is great. And, oh, all these institutions, they're just burdens upon me. And if I could just get away from them, you know, things would be better. Sometimes you think about Little House on the Prairie, and you know, and Paul was like that. You know, he just didn't want. Oh man, over the last week I saw two carts drive down the road. Okay, it's time to move. We got to get out of here. Well, that's basically the same idea. Okay, like any good socialist institution, within a few years the farm fell apart, and because it had no money. So this farm didn't last very long, and transcendentalism was a very small movement. It only lasted for a little bit of time, but because of the influence through writing, and they also had lyceums, and these were lecture halls. And so, you know, you didn't have TV and radio back then, so what people did for fun was they would go to hear lectures and hear people speak. And so you had these transcendentalists going to these lecture halls and reading their papers and spreading their ideas, and the people were coming, and, you know, it was like going to a Shakespeare play or something, but it was a lecture. And so they were getting influence that way as well. So books, poems, newspaper, lectures. They were teaching at places like Harvard. So Brook Farm Colony fell apart because they had no money. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this whole, you know, they did, because this is the most interesting part, I think, about transcendentalism. It began as a movement that was known for not trusting institutions at all. And this was a very Hegelian idea, Hegel. His view was, one of the things he said was, you everything that's out there, you have thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. Antithesis, I should say. And then synthesis. And the idea is that everything that's out there can be tested. You take what is purported as a truth, and you run it through a non-truth, a negative, you know, barrier, or, you know, and then you get the actual truth that comes through it. Of course, Hegel is not necessarily applying it the way they're applying it, but what this does is it sort of trains people to believe that there is no truth. Everything out there needs to be questioned. Everything out there needs to be run through this system. And so they didn't trust any institution at all. And a lot of their writings were attacking institutions. They attacked everything. Doesn't matter what it was. The church, the government. They hated government. They hated the state. The state was bad. Thoreau went out to Walden because of he hated the state. Thoreau was a full-on anarchist. I mean, this guy, at one point, he decided that he was going to cast off every bond that subjected him. You know, even the idea, so he wrote letters to everything telling them that he was no longer a member of their society. And it didn't matter what the state he was born in, he just naturally was a citizen. He wrote a letter to him, no longer a citizen of your state. His mother, you know, as a you know, he was born and baptized in a church. He wrote a letter to him, no longer a Christian in your church. It didn't matter if it was just an innocent, you know, like we're part of institutions just by being born and just by where we live. And he was like, I'm going to get rid of all of it. Like, he was a thorough anarchist. But so this idea of man was inherently good and could move towards perfection in a perfect society was the proof. So they were attacking all these institutions. Sin, evil, was only because of these institutions. They were preventing people from knowing truth. They were preventing people from being their own person, from realizing the God within them. If they could only do that, if they could cast off institutions, then they could grow and mature into Well, Thoreau, in his book, Civil Disobedience, talks about the four levels of man. First level of man is a slave. Second level of man is a subject. You know, so they start, you get out of slavery, now you're a subject. You know, and you get out of being a subject, you're a citizen. And then eventually, if you can cast off all of these institutions and all these boundaries, you know, these obstacles, you can be a glorified being. You know, you can be beyond law. And then this matched up with his four views of the state. There was the worst, the slave, you know, the four levels of man matched up with the four levels of state. So you have slave and you have absolute monarchy. That's the worst. But then you can move up to limited monarchy. And then democracy. So even, he, you know, democracy, he had critiques of democracy. And then the ideal, you know, this Plato, you know, if you became the glorified man, then heaven is sort of this ideal state where there is no more laws. There's no need for rules, no need for laws. You are the perfect person. And if everybody is perfect, you don't have to have any kind of institution or law or authority. Now, in Weaver's other essay on Thoreau, he talks about, well, before I say that, not only did they attack institutions, but the other thing they did was they were big into social reform. Because again, if everybody could just attain perfection, so what we need to do is we need to get rid of these oppressive systems. And so social reform, they wrote against, you know, they were the social activists of the day. So they were writing articles on the Crusade for World Peace, labor reform, the women's right to vote, prohibition, prison reform, and abolitionism. All these things, and many of them good. I mean, you know, it's the tricky part is we see that today. You know, the left sometimes, you know, like they'll get behind a cause, and there are good things about the cause, but it's the way they do it. It's the wrong way to cast away bad things. You know, there, you can actually make things worse. Seems very, I don't want to get into that because we're running out of time, but maybe you know what I mean. This is the same thing. Like they were sitting here talking about the evils of all these institutions, but Richard Weaver makes the point that they never had a, this is how you do it. It was always, these things are evil, we must be rid of them, but never had a solution. So In his essay, sort of critiquing Thoreau, he compares Thoreau to one of the founding fathers, the John Randolph, and the different ways they approached trying to reform, you know, their state or their community. And he says that John Randolph inherited slaves, and I don't. It just said that he was not able to get to let them go. So I think there was some sort of legal thing. But he had these slaves that he inherited, and he always was regretted that he was not able to let them go. But he was able to at his death. So in his will, he owned slaves, but in his will, he gave them their freedom, gave them each like this absorb, like, I mean, I think it was like $50,000 for each slave and 100 acres of land. Like it was just like, okay, when I can't do it now, but when I die, I'm going to give you all this stuff, all this land. And so, you know, you think about today, I mean, he would be, what would we call it, canceled, you know, because he owns slaves. But here's a man that has a plan, and he's looking at it, and he goes, okay, the future needs to look this way, and what can I do to help these people? You read Thoreau's anti-slavery papers, there's not one thing in there that talks about, here's a plan. We just need to, you know, we just need to end this institution. Well, how are you going to do that? What are you going to do? Okay, if you set them free, what's the plan? Are you going to give some money to them? Are you going to help them yourself? And of course, that is, you know, again, that Paul Johnson book's so great for this. I mean, he points that out. Rousseau, Marx, all these leftist, you know, these people that talked about these ideals, they never did a thing to help people. They just wrote about the wickedness of these things. Let me jump ahead here because we got 5 minutes. But so This view of man, of course, was a continuation of the deistic view of man, that mankind... Oh, I'm reading the wrong one. So that sounded familiar. So because the transcendentalist movement was small and was focused primarily on the theoretical and the metaphysical, they realized their movement would not last, and the ideal paradise may not be achieved. So they had all these big aspirations, and because nobody worked, they didn't make money, and their little commune failed. And then they're thinking, okay, what can we do? Like, we're about to lose all these grand and glorious things that we've worked so hard for. And that's when the compromise happens, you know. And so their biggest social reform that they were working towards was abolition. And so all of a sudden, the Civil War is looming, and they got to make a decision. And you know what? The government, maybe they're not a bad institution after all. You know, maybe now the church still is bad. And some of these other institutions are bad, but the government, you know what? They're actually pretty good. And so what they did is they hooked their horse to the government and abolitionism. And that was, and so as the Civil War loomed, they put all of their energy into promoting and supporting the war. And you read some of the things that Thoreau and Emerson write, and it's just horrible stuff. I mean, they're just, I mean, some of these guys, they went from this peaceful transcendental movement to, I don't care, like, women and children in the South, kill them, burn their houses down. That's what they, I mean, this, they literally wrote these things. I mean, these were, oh, wait, you know, all this peace and forget it. Let's just kill them. You know, we need to, the only way we're going to achieve perfection is if we get rid of all these bad people. And so as the Civil War loomed, they got behind the abolitionist movement, made it a big political issue, promoted the war, and then they won. I mean, because of the way the war ended up, the transcendentalists won. Their movement, they got victory. And so So again, they supported a tax on property rights. They endorsed the John Brown terrorist attacks. They wrote favorably in regards to the way the South was treated. They believed that all the property of the South should be taken away from them and burned or just repurposed for other, you know, for the North. But by attaching their progressive view of religion to a strong centralized state, in other words, because they took their movement they distrusted the government, but now they've attached their movement to the government. Now you have, because the North won, because a strong centralized government won the war, you now have this transcendental idea of perfectionism through the state now. It's no longer through these ideas. It's no longer reaching perfection through reaching out to the God that's within you or through fighting for the rights of others. It's now through the force of the state, through the force of a strong centralized government, perfection can be reached. And this is what, so the transcendental movement died right after that. As Thoreau and Emerson died, the movement dies with them. Transcendentalism is like this little 40-year experiment that happened, but it had massive ramifications in our history. Because of that, right now, that what happened, you know, history and the way things played out, and you have this massive moment in history with the Civil War and the transcendentalists moving up into that moment and the outcome of the war, their view won the day. Now, again, I mentioned this last week, and we're not going to have time to really get into it, but, you know, the Puritanism, the Calvinism of the Puritans that slowly went away, when you get to the Civil War, that, I mentioned this last week with Presbyterianism, that view is now in the South, and it was starting to take root. And it maybe was not the same way that the Puritans did, but the South had a very strong Calvinistic Christian worldview in place. Very, very, a lot more ethical, stronger morality. So the war, in a sense, also put an end to that. You know, of course, you know, we all know we live in the South, so there is this sort of, you know, everybody's a Christian down here in the South, and that has sort of carried on, and we'll talk about that more next week. But it is interesting how in some parts of the country, the sort of the Puritan ideal was starting to take shape again, but then a war comes and sort of snuffs it out and sort of puts a stop to it. But yeah, and we'll talk about that more next week as we get into the mid-1800s. So this is the Transcendental Movement was probably done officially. The Transcendentalist Commune was done in the 1840s, early 1840s. So it, even at that point, it was starting to die. But the ideas, the thoughts, the religion of it was carrying on and then into the Civil War. But we'll probably, so I guess technically we're ending around the 1860s, 1870s. But we'll probably take a few steps back and start maybe in the 1850s next week and start talking about Darwinism and how it started affecting our culture and our politics. So.